Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
It's time for our Friday gathering now, and this week I'm joined by Pippa Hackett, Green Party Senator and Minister of State for Land Use and Biodiversity at the Department of Agriculture, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal and spokesperson on workers' rights, enterprise, trade and employment, Jack Horgan-Jones, political correspondent with the Irish Times, and Aisling Maloney, who's political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, and you're all very welcome. We're going to start with last night's events in Newtown, Mount Kennedy in Wicklow. It's the first time since these protests began that we've had arrests at the scene. We've had Garda cars damaged. We've had the Garda commissioner down there this morning making a very strong statement about what happened. Pippa, do you think that this represents a change now in how these incidents are policed?
Look, firstly, I think what the scenes from Newtown Mount Kennedy were horrific to see, and I welcome the fact that there have been six arrests, and I think it is good that the commissioner was there. I think that is it's significant that he has made that appearance, and I think that is a good thing. I think there's real fear there, but the fear isn't among people from the migrants. The fear is from these protesters, supposed protesters, who are now, you know, acting criminally. There are bad faith actors among them. I think everyone can agree that. I mean, who brings an axe to a protest, for example? Who decides to start, you know, hurtling rocks and missiles at the Gardaí? And who decides to start damaging three Garda cars? That is not acceptable. I think it's good to see the strength from the Gardaí to arrest people. And I think, look, people have to, we cannot tolerate this in our society. Well, and people can make excuses all they like, but anyone I think defending anything like this, or anyone who's making excuses for this behaviour, needs to be called out.
Well, people are possibly afraid because they feel that up to now, certainly, this has been tolerated and that law and order has been allowed to break down.
Well, I think, as you say, I think perhaps we have maybe seen a turning point, and it is welcome, because I think there has been a little bit of a, I think there has been concern. I think the Gardaí have been careful and cautious not to try and fuel these supposed protests, because we know there are those characters there who are not there, who don't give two hoots about migrants coming to Ireland. They're there to stir up trouble. They're waving tricolours around, and that's not what we need to see. And I think more of this, please, from the Gardaí.
Okay, and we have a statement in the last couple of minutes from Sinn Féin's justice spokesperson, Pa Daly, who says, amongst other things, we must be unequivocal in both our support for the Gardaí and condemnation of criminality. Violence and damage to property are totally unacceptable, as death or serious injury will surely follow, Louise.
Yeah, and I think Pa's right. I think the by all accounts, and I want to tell you, Claire, I try and avoid watching those videos because I try where I can, okay? But I have seen some of it, everyone has, and I've read the media reports. And by all accounts, Gardaí came under a sustained attack. Gardaí vehicles were damaged. The Gardaí themselves were clearly under attack there. And I think Pa is right in saying, you know, we are, you know, we have to be supportive of an Garda Síochána, you know, but they also need to be resourced. You know, the one thing that people will say to you all of the time, it's whether you're in the north inner city or out in Balbriggan, they will say a visible Garda presence is what they want to see. The Gardaí themselves will tell you that they are under-resourced in terms of personnel and in terms of equipment. That needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, what we saw, there's no place for that.
Yeah, I'm just going back now to Pa Daly's statement. He says, Garda, ye have powers available where demonstrators are engaging in threatening behaviour, blocking roads and entrances to workplaces and setting fires. So, is Sinn Féin saying now, where you have protesters blocking roads, that the Gardaí should go in heavy on those people?
No, that's not what Pa's saying at all. What we're saying is the powers exist already for the Gardaí, but they do need the resources, of course. But the powers exist for them to ensure that they can maintain good order, so that they can ensure people have access to their workplace. And that's specifically mentioned there. You know, blocking the entrance to a person's workplace is not right. But we do need to see the Gardaí properly resourced so that they can police.
What about the fear that you know, if the Gardaí turn up in riot gear, in the public order gear, that they inflame the situation and that everything gets worse?
But that's a call for the Gardaí to make. the unfortunate thing is that sometimes where an additional Garda presence might be required, that is not available, and that's a resourcing issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Aisling, to come to you, that this, what we saw, the response to this and the words from the Garda Commissioner this morning represent a change in how these protests will be policed?
Potentially, Claire, but we're talking about this with over a year. I mean, last May there was an incident where migrant tents were burnt out when, again, we couldn't house all of our asylum seekers. Again, there was a blockade of an asylum seeker centre in Clare in last June, I think it was, or May. This has been going on, and Minister Hackett was saying there about, you know, that these being, I suppose, far-right agitators coming into local communities and whipping up, and you were saying there that fuels the protest. But has the lack of the Garda response and a lack of a heavy hand from the Guard also fueled that? Has it buoyed people? Has it made those people who went to places like Clare, went to Mount Street and held protest, and now moving to Newtown Mount Kennedy, has it fueled up those people? Because they're buoyed by the lack of repercussions or consequences thus far. I mean, we've had, I think, over 10, like, I don't know the exact figure right now, it could be 14 at this stage, arson attacks on facilities marked for asylum seekers. So is it a little too late now for this response from Drew Harris? Obviously, last night, the Gardaí came under, as you say, attack when they went to control what was happening down there at Newtown Mount Kennedy. But I mean, the Dublin riots last year were unprecedented, and that did stem as well from anti-migrant rhetoric being whipped up on the streets in a protest that then tumbled into something else entirely. Is it a little too late? And I think people are scared. The public are scared to see people in Newtown Mount Kennedy, the locals there are scared to see what's happening around them in that instance. But also, you had the councillor, Fine Gael councillor Irene Winters, on earlier, and she was saying, you know, it isn't really appropriate to have tented people in tents in Newtown Mount Kennedy, and that's what's happening. The government are erecting, a higher grade, let's say, tent to accommodate these people, and they're saying, well, we don't really agree with that. But is it the government decision that you're disagreeing with, or is it having those people in your community at all? And that's what, I suppose, when you're outside where they're going to be housed, that question has to be asked.
It is
a government decision.
It does feel, Jack, like a lot of this now is coming to a head. It's a very tricky situation for government, for the Gardaí to deal with. Where are we now, do you think, this morning? Assess where you think this leaves us.
Well, I think that there has been a step change. The problem with this, with policing these protests, and perhaps protests, at least on occasion, should be in inverted commas, but maybe that's a conversation for another day. The problem with policing them has been that you're kind of damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you go in with the heavy hand, well, then the argument runs that you're giving the far-right agitators the footage that supports their worldview, that the state is coming down heavy on you because you're criticising or protesting the state. If you don't, well, then get criticism for the other side, you know, for saying that you're tacitly encouraging, protests at people's homes, whether that be migrant accommodation centres or indeed politicians, as we saw with Roderick O'Gorman last week. I think that what changed this week is that there's a very clear signal now from on high in the government to the policing side of things to firm things up. And I think we see it, we hear that today with what Pippa said, but we heard it on Monday or Tuesday, whenever you had Simon Harris on your programme as well. I think that the message was clear that there was a concern about the perception that the guards weren't using their powers to the fullest extent, you know, and they need to be given operational latitude, of course. But I do think that when you have a kind of volume of incidents being repeated, perhaps seemingly ad nauseum, where the guards seem to be standing back, I think Aisling's right. I think it does further the impression that people can act with impunity.
I'm just going back to the comments from the Garda Commissioner this morning, and he made the point that the workers were coming in there and it is the job of the Gardaí to keep the peace and allow those workers to get on with, as he said, their legitimate business and to make sure that they are protected. But if you look at back at what happened in Ross Grey, when you had migrants who were due to stay in that hotel and their children coming to stay in that hotel, and there were protests happening there and there were attempts to prevent them from gaining access, the response was different. So does that provide evidence that there has been a step change here in policing?
Yeah, I think there has. And I think that, you know, you talk about workers being prevented from going to their place of work. Like, that seems to have happened in Newtown Mount Kennedy. But equally, I don't think that's anything new either. I think that has happened at other protests. Certainly, I've seen
where people have
footage of construction workers and other people who are going in to overhaul buildings or make them ready to house migrants, and they're having cameras shoved in their faces. Mm-hmm. So I don't think necessarily the methodology of protests has changed, but I think that the reaction from the guards certainly seems to have changed last night at Trotter House.
But as you say, the arrests, I mean, that deters people if they are thinking of going out and protesting peacefully. That's obviously one cohort of people, but if there are people going out there with an intention to cause some trouble, you know, if they've seen now that there has been arrests, then that shows that, well, if I do, you know, act with impunity or whatever, that there will be consequences.
It's been one of the kind of frustrating things looking at this for so long has been the fact that, you know, going back to when Simon Harris was temporarily Justice Minister, he was talking at length about how there was a band of people travelling up and down the country inciting this, you know, and it seems that there was no kind of intelligence-led response to tackle that. So into that space, which you leave open, you know, people are going to emerge and occupy and act as they have been doing.
Pippa, you want to come
I mean,
in?
I was just going to say, I mean, I spoke with a resident of Newtown Mount Kennedy this morning, and she was saying, like, there is a cohort in Newtown Mount Kennedy who are willing to welcome migrants to their communities. They're supportive of that, but they're intimidated, you know, to come out, and you couldn't come out and say you're welcome because you've got this motley crew with their faces half covered, potentially going to throw something at you. So it's suppressive, it's chilling. It's all of those awful feelings that we don't want to have.
Can I read you this message? And we've had very many from a listener this morning. The lack of communication from the government and the general feeling of no confidence in the asylum process is causing major unrest in communities across the country. Workers arrive at sites to adapt them for asylum seekers at night under the cover of darkness, and it all seems very sneaky to the people living in the communities. Nobody seems to know what the plan is or is giving an official statement. It's happening in towns all across the country. And this person says, I fear these incidents will become more frequent and dangerous if clear and adequate communication with communities is not taken seriously by government. And we had your party colleague on, Joe O'Brien, during the week. He basically said the same, that this communication strategy, which we've been hearing about coming from government, it's not there yet.
Well, I think this is something that's been long, you know, pointed to government about the communications. But again,
well, it's something you said you were going to do.
Absolutely, and we know absolutely needs to be done, and it will be done. But I think in terms of a venue or a community by community, that can be flipped on its head, because what we've seen as well, when you do give the communication, you have the build up of aggression and
so you're saying the government doesn't know what to do here?
No, I'm not saying that. But I mean, we do need the plan. We will get it out. We will be rolling out the communication plan around this. But there are so many good examples. We get caught up in all these awful, terrible examples, but there's so many wonderful examples across the country, my own community in Offaly, where integration has worked really well, where migrants have been warmly welcomed into communities. And it's a shame we don't see a little bit more of that, to actually reassure maybe some people with genuine concerns that this can work.
Isn't it the case, Pippa, though, that notwithstanding the new plan that Roderick O'Gorman brought to Cabinet and was approved in recent weeks, that, you know, the day-to-day experience of sourcing and providing accommodation for migrants is not going to change anytime soon?
I think, look, clearly what the needs of the current moment are emergency needs, and that's why it's tented accommodation. It's not ideal. It's not where we want to see it. But the long-term plan for integration, you know, has three elements to it. You know, firstly, to use the state land for maybe prefab and modular units. Secondly, to examine the availability
but
of private empty
sector,
commercial
private sector, the use of the private sector, the use of hotels, that's going to continue for years, isn't it?
Well, I think there will be a certain element of that, but we do know there are challenges around that as well. That's not ideal either. That's temporary. The third part of it is to target the purchase, you know, that the state owns these larger potentially buildings.
But if the state owns it, it's still in a community. The community may not like agree with it.
Well, I know, but it's state owned, it's different. It takes the pressure off maybe like the tourism sector, which is challenged for this. So there are so many sides and angles to this, and we can focus on one part of it or we can look at it as the whole. And
yeah,
we do need to look at it
to be
as
fair,
the whole.
To be fair, people, I think people are... they're quite tired of hearing the same announcements over and over again from the government. I mean, I genuinely...
Well, those three announcements aren't the same. They're only quite
recent. I don't
recent.
Know how many times the reception centre's announcement now has been made. And it's, I think it was originally four, maybe it's six now. Still no idea where they're going to go. No thought of a communication plan actually being put in place. There's talk about it, but it's not actually working. And I think, you know, you do need to understand that where you're living in a small town, and you can't access a creche place. I mean, there's whole towns in Ireland where they don't have creches, where you can't get an appointment to see your GP, where you're worried about whether or not your kids are going to get a space in the school. When the government come to talk to you about additional personnel in that village, they should come with a plan, but they don't. And that what happens in the intervening time in between the announcement being floated, and it's very often not made publicly, it's leaked out and misinformation seeps into that space. And then all of a sudden the government are having to deal with a crisis of their own making. But if you are upfront and honest with people and you communicate, I mean, saying to people, we're building 6 reception centres, but we're not going to tell you where they are. Well, we might tell you before the election, 1 or 2, or maybe after the election. I mean,
well, we tried to find out about that this week from Simon Harris when he was in, and he said that the announcement was imminent. But we did hear in January that we would be finding out then imminently where the first one would be. I mean, what is the big mystery? I don't understand. If there's a plan there, tell people. Pippa, do you get it?
I think part of the challenge is they do have to be identified to these spaces. I mean, we're using City West, and that's going to be extended for a little bit longer under the current. I mean, ideally it would be better perhaps if the state bought City West, but they can't. It's not available for sale, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a difficulty about, you know, we can't just buy what we want. We're not going to go into CPOing large buildings around the country.
But
I think that would be a challenge.
Get into doing what you said you were going to do, which is build the reception centres, tell people where they're going to be, communicate with people, and then put a plan in place to put the resources in.
We will
in.
Be using state lands for modular units, for prefabricated units. We will
where?
Be doing that.
Where and when?
State lands that have to become available
where?
From different agencies.
Where?
I don't have the plan in front of me,
See,
Louise.
This is the point.
I don't have it.
But you've been talking about it now for years,
There is work going on to identify proper sites, to appropriate sites, sites that are going to be close to, as you say, whether it's going to be public transport or services, et cetera, to facilitate this. I think the bottom line is here that this is not going to be solved overnight. It does need
a
plan.
Well, the suspicion is that you don't want to tell, the government doesn't want to tell us about these sites before the local and European elections. That's what people.
Well, that's not my view on it at all. And I think that's a bit of a shallow thing, because this is something that's going to be going on for years and decades ahead. Migration is going to be a significant factor across the world, and there's very little any of us can do about that other than to support people who come, and also support countries who are challenged with people leaving their country for all sorts of reasons.
Jack, can I come back to what Joe O'Brien said? Because you interviewed him, and then we followed up with it on this programme, and he spoke about this as he saw it, a lack of political will to find beds at that cabinet subcommittee chaired by Leo Varadkar. What does that say about how the problem is being addressed at a very senior level in government?
Well, I think it expresses one of the kind of threads that has been running through this for months, if not well over a year, which is the sense that Roderick O'Gorman's department and him individually, and perhaps Joe O'Brien and the Minister of State in the department, have been kind of left to some extent
carrying the can.
Yeah. And I think that what was interesting about Joe O'Brien's intervention is that this is the first time that a Green minister has vocalised this, you know, on the record, you know, this sense that people, yes, had been asked to look for buildings, but that perhaps they hadn't been asked that hard, you know, and they hadn't looked that hard.
And the communication plan or lack of it was a source of frustration for him as well.
Yeah, I know. And we were told again today that the communication plan is imminent, but sure.
Let's say a year ago.
Yeah.
They announced it a year ago when it happened in Clare with McGowna House. They said we need a clear communication strategy here.
Yes, and look, there's also potentially something comforting in the idea that a communications plan is going to solve all this. I don't think it will. Like, what is also interesting is that while we've been talking about the accommodation side of things here today, because of what's happened up in Newtown and Kennedy, there has been a shift, I think, in the debate in the last week or so, perhaps away from the political centre of gravity being around accommodation and towards it being about borders and you know, asylum and processes that ultimately reside under the Minister of Justice and the Department of Justice.
People coming through from Northern Ireland,
from the north. This extraordinary statistic that Helen McEntee offered at the Justice Committee earlier on this week, that the supposition really is that 80% of people who are applying for asylum here are now.
Sure, how do you deal with that? I mean, we had a big conversation about this with people who know a lot more about it than we do, but it's a very difficult one to address, it would seem.
It's also very difficult to quantify. The 80%, I mean, there's no clarity from the Taoiseach or the Justice Minister as to what they're basing it on, the people who come to
It's a proxy. It's not a hard data point. You know, now, it's probably as good a guess as you can possibly get, but it's not a hard data point. It's basically, it's who's turning up at Mount Street versus who's seeking asylum at ports or airports. What do you do about it? I mean, like, I don't think there's a clear, straightforward answer to that. I think it's interesting that the government, when they're asked about this, they talk about things like, oh, you know, there's faster processing times coming through. And while that has worked with individual jurisdictions where you put someone on someone coming from Georgia, for example, on a safe country list, and the processing times come down and the numbers of people fall from that jurisdiction. If you look at the overall trend, the line is going skywards, you know. So it seems that even as conditions change on the ground, whether it's to do with the rapidity of processing or whether it's to do with the fact that you can't actually house everyone who's coming here anymore, this trend is kind of tidal, you know. It's it's baked in, so it's going to become an even greater part of our politics. And I think it's expanding now beyond, and I think a lot of this has to do with the emphasis that Simon Harris has put on the justice side of things since he became teacher. It's expanding now beyond accommodation, and people are starting to ask questions. You saw Michael McNamara challenging Helen McAtee at the committee during the week. People are starting to ask questions about the efficiency and the effectiveness of that system for returns and appeals, and just how quickly it works or perhaps doesn't work.
What are you going to do about the UK situation? Like, if you have all these people coming in from the UK and we decide here, well, we're going to send you back to the UK, but the Irish courts say you can't send that person back to the UK because they're going to be put on a flight to Rwanda and we don't believe Rwanda is a safe country.
Well, I think there needs to be you know, very clear discussions with the British government in relation to this. I think this underlines why we shouldn't be opting in wholesale into the EU migration pact, because there are things about this state that are unique, that are not features of the rest of the European Union, and about which we need to be able to make our own arrangements. But that does involve dialogue with the British government, which I'm assuming, and maybe Pippa will confirm, that is going to happen. I mean, the minister was at committee. I didn't see all of it. I read the media reports of some of it, and she gave statistics. She gave figures. But again, as Jack has said, you know, they're not necessarily hard data facts. So we need to interrogate that. You know, there needs to be hard data there, and there needs to be an engagement with the British government, which I think is important, and that should happen. But it does underline the fact that we are unique. We have a land border, and that needs to be taken into account in our legislation.
All right, I want to move on now, because the other big story that dominated the headlines this week was the inquest into the death of Aoife Johnston. And that's been front of mind, anyone paying attention to it this week, those really harrowing details of what her family went through and what they experienced at University Hospital Limerick in 2022 when she died. And we've had senior doctors saying that she hadn't a hope in that emergency department and that it was a death trap, just an extraordinary indictment of the health service in this country. This surely, Pippa, should be a watershed moment.
Look, I think that the whole thing is just so tragic. Just firstly want to, you know, offer my sincere condolences to Aoife's family, her sisters, her parents and her friends, because, I mean, nothing is really going to make up for this loss for them. This is, you know, catastrophic in their lives. Look, certainly we do need to look at what the coroner's recommendations have said. We know that we're waiting for the work of retired Chief Justice Frank Clark, who's, I think, to conclude his independent work over the coming weeks. I think that we need to examine all of that together before we make any decisions. But I think, look, there have been challenges at UHL that have been, you know, highlighted.
But it's intolerable. It's not acceptable. A bereaved mother standing outside the inquest saying, "I wouldn't send any of my other children to this place."
No, and I agree. It's absolutely not acceptable to have that. I mean, confidence is obviously very low now in the hospital, and we have to work hard as a government to reinstill confidence. We need a properly functioning hospital in that area in Limerick, you know, and people are shocked. So that's what Minister Donnelly is working hard and Bernard Glass and the HSE to try and do that. You know, there's challenges with capacity, challenges with beds, challenges with the management, and we can learn from other hospitals. There are hospitals across Ireland doing it
Louise,
better.
You want to come in there?
Claire, this is not new. And I know that, you know, and I do want to extend my sympathies to Aoife's family and to our friends and to our loved ones. I know my heart is breaking for them, and I'm sure their hearts are broken. But what's happening in Limerick Hospital is not new. previous to my role in politics, I worked as a full-time union official. 2008 to 2009 was the first time we had a ballot for industrial action, that I had a ballot for industrial action in UHL, and it was overcrowding in A&E. So that's a long time
what
ago.
At what level can you remember?
35. 35 were the numbers overnight. And at that stage, we had nurses and doctors and porters and cleaners and everybody working in the A&E department saying that it was intolerable, saying that it was inevitable that...
On this night in 2022, there were 190 patients
in the emergency department. I can't even conceive of what that is like for the patients and for the staff. I mean, they used phrases like war zone and death trap. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, the A&E that provides services to three counties. You know, this is a major hospital. And, you know, when you see, and I know people like Mary Fogarty from the INMO, and she's represented the nurses down there so well over the years. But when you talk to Mary and she tells you they are fighting all the time, and what they're fighting for is staff, resources and capacity. Mm-hmm. So it is not new.
Well, it's the emergency departments closed, didn't they, in St. John's and Limerick City, in Nina and in Ennis after that protest that you're talking about in 2008. So subsequent to that, we had those closures, and all of the campaigners will say that is behind the problems at UHL.
Well, what's actually what was promised at the time, and I think it was the last time Pippa's party were in government, what was promised at the time was a centre of excellence. I mean, it's hard to believe it now that that was what was promised. What was promised was a centre of excellence, and the centre of excellence would be in UL, and nobody would want to go anywhere else except this centre of excellence. That was never delivered on. What should have happened, if the intention and the clinical advice was that services had to be scaled back in the surrounding counties, they should have beefed up the services in Limerick first. They didn't. And we see the result of that now. So I understand that the government and the government representatives will want to paint this as something that is new. It's not new. It's not news. And the failure of successive governments to deal with it has brought us to where we are now. But for me, for my part, the people who are working in the ED in Limerick today, tomorrow and the next day, they are absolutely heartily sick of successive government representatives.
How do you solve it? How do you
resources and capacity? So you need to put beds into the system.
I just said that,
Louise.
I said that in my opening.
But sorry, and that like, one of the things that I genuinely struggle to wrap my head around when it comes to the problem of UHL is that I know there's extra bed blocks under construction down there, but like the resources have flowed seemingly to that hospital, right? Like, so there's 45% budget increase since 2019 and many, many hundreds more staff. So I struggle to square exactly where the problem is. I mean, obviously there is something of a resources problem, but it can't entirely be explained by resources.
The problem is beds. There are not enough beds. If
there's 86 beds coming on for next winter, and there's a bed, as Jack has alluded to, 96. There's 96 in a new bed block, but it's also capacity, and it's also better on-site management. And I think that's probably where the crux of this issue is. I mean, with the situation...
What's the government's view of on-site management?
There's 190 people on trolleys, then there's 190 beds short.
What's the view of on-site management at UHL?
Look, I think when you look at comparing what's happening in UHL with other hospitals, I mean, there's only like 28% of the UHL emergency medical consultants who are on the public only contract. That's much bigger in other hospitals. It's working better. You're having more people being...
So you think it's the staff?
No, sorry, don't interrupt me, please. You're having more... No, but you have a different management structure. You have people working more weekends. You're moving patients out over the weekend. You're freeing up space. You're freeing up capacity.
Connor Ducey,
that's the challenge instead of adding
to it
all the time.
Already, Minister, there's just not enough of them. That's the problem. I mean, if you are paid to work a shift and you work that shift and you go home, it is not your fault if there's nobody to take up the remainder of the balance of the day.
I'm blaming the staff, it's really poor.
I used to live down in Limerick and I've been into the regional. I was admitted to the emergency department once there, and you're terrified. You are. You're going in, you're going, oh my God, like this is going to be horrible. And when I went in there, I was fine. But obviously for other people, the situation does not turn out like that. And to talk about Aoife Johnston's death as a watershed moment, it is kind of to say that everyone that's come before her with a similarly tragic case wasn't. I mean, you're talking about 2018, a man called Tommy Wynne, a 65-year-old man, died in April 2018 after 36 hours on a trolley with stroke-like symptoms. Why wasn't that a watershed moment? I mean, there's so many people who've gone in there, languished on trolleys. They may not have actually met their death on a trolley,
but they may have had a much worse outcome. I mean, the idea that 15 years ago they closed the three EDs in Ennis, Nenagh and St John's, and they said that UHL would be a centre of excellence, and 15 years later people are still terrified to go into that emergency department. Their consultants and medical professionals at that inquest this week saying the situation is still horrific there. And the idea that you would pursue the same strategy and keep pursuing it, rather than saying, look, what's happened in the Midwest has not worked. The strategy we pursued has not worked so far. Mm-hmm. We need to change tack. And it doesn't seem that the government is doing that. They're continually saying that the issues are on the ground in UHL, rather than maybe it being a bigger issue of the Midwest and not having a Model 3 hospital to support UHL.
Do you concede, Pippa, that that might be what's needed? I was saying there that Conor Deasy from the Association of Emergency Medicine, he was saying the 96 extra beds that are planned, they're just not going to cut it. Like, it's hundreds of beds that you need. And it seems to point to, as Aisling said, another hospital, another facility is needed in the region, not a better UHL.
Look, I'm not the expert on this. I don't have the figures in front of me, and I don't know, you know, how that works best. But the point of the matter is, we are putting the resources there. We are building more beds. If more beds are needed, then we need to build more beds. If that's as simple as the problem, I feel the problem is deeper than just more beds. I think there's a challenge there that needs to be addressed. And I think Minister Donnelly has acknowledged that. You know, UHL need to do
many
better.
Times, and his predecessor has acknowledged it. There's no shortage of acknowledgements. What there is a shortage of an actual plan.
Okay.
On Friday, my colleague David Cullinan will launch our plan on how we would deal with it with Maurice Quinlivan down in Limerick next
week. All right, we need to leave it there. Thank you all very much for coming in.